we're better off waiting until we come back.
Congress begins a lame duck session while Senator Stevens' fate is still up in the air. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 17th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a look at why high school graduation rates are so low in Alaska.
We have a pipeline to build, a natural gas pipeline to build, and we need high school graduates who can learn those skills to do that work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com.
Congress convened today, and Alaska's delegation is back in Washington after the campaign season. But the return to the Capitol may be especially trying for one member, Senator Ted Stevens. The seven-term senator still does not yet know if he's won re-election to his seat. Stevens trails Democratic Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich by 1,022 votes. About 24,000 more ballots are expected to be counted tomorrow, bringing the race closer to resolution. In the meantime, Stevens faces a challenging week in Washington. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senate Republicans will meet Tuesday morning behind closed doors, and one thing on their agenda is the future of Senator Stevens' place in their ranks. Alaska's senior senator was convicted last month of failure to disclose gifts on financial forms. Despite being a convicted felon, he is allowed to return to work on Capitol Hill. Only a two-thirds vote of the Senate can expel him from office. That drastic step was talked about by some Republicans on the campaign trail, but if a vote on that does happen, it's not likely to take place until the next Congress, and so would only go forward if Stevens wins re-election. But in the meantime, Republicans have another option. They can kick Stevens out of their party's caucus. While he would still have a seat in the Senate, Stevens would be stripped of committee spots and would not be able to vote on party issues. When the federal indictments came down in July, Stevens gave up his leadership roles on committees, but still sits on them as a member for now. South Carolina Republican Jim DeMint wants to vote on whether to remove Stevens from the conference and has put it on Tuesday's agenda. The ballot will be secret. But now with Stevens' re-election fate up in the air, some Republicans may want to wait and not act this week. If Stevens loses the election, there may be less of a push for his ouster. However, the secret conference vote is scheduled to take place Tuesday morning before any updates come from the Alaska Division of Elections about the race. So on Tuesday, Senator Ted Stevens' 85th birthday, he'll be fighting to keep his stature as the Senate's longest-serving Republican. Meanwhile, freshman congressmen are in Washington for orientation. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid met the new Democratic senators, and they took an official freshman class photo. But Alaska still doesn't know if it will be sending a new senator to Washington or not. Until the vote tally is resolved, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich is staying in Alaska. Begich's press secretary, Julie Haskett, says they're not assuming anything, with thousands of ballots yet to be counted.
We would find it presumptuous to attend freshman orientation and not really appropriate at this point. So we're just waiting for those ballots to be counted. And if, in fact, Mayor Begich is the next U.S. senator, then he will hit the ground running and get up to speed as quickly as he can.
Haskett says Begich is getting calls from senators and friends in Washington who are keeping him up to speed about what's going on right now. There's a question of how much actual lawmaking will be accomplished during this week's lame duck session. Democrats want legislation to aid the auto industry, and they also want a stimulus package. It looks like both sides will tackle extending unemployment benefits, which will expire next month if Congress doesn't vote to renew. But major movement may have to wait until the new Congress and new president come into office in January. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada said today that an anticipated lands package will not be taken up in this week's lame duck session. Instead, it will be given to the new Congress to deal with in January. The package includes a proposed land swap in Alaska in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Village of King Cove wants the land to build a road on what's now designated wilderness. The village says the road is necessary to connect their community with Cold Bay, which has an airport. Environmentalists are opposed to the swap and say the land is irreplaceable. But the bill passed out of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee this fall with the approval of Democratic Senator Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico. Senator Reed says the lands package has a better chance of passing in January than it does this week.
Rather than move forward on the lands package, which is hundreds of bills that are so important to a lot of people, a lot of senators, and certainly a lot of people around the country, that we're better off waiting until we come back.
Reed says some unnamed senators threatened to use a rare Senate rule that would require the entire 700-page bill to be read aloud as a stalling tactic. Reed said that would take more than 24 hours and clog up this week's session. He said that made postponing the obvious choice.
But one of the first things we're going to do is there will be a bipartisan piece of legislation introduced that will include all the stuff that has been held up this past 2 years, these so-called lands bills. That will be the first or second thing that we do when we come back in January.
The Eisenbeck land swap bill was sponsored by Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. And Senator Murkowski was in Anchorage on Saturday taking testimony from educators and academics on how the federal government can help improve high school graduation rates and boost post-secondary success. University of Alaska President Mark Hamilton said, although it's unfortunate that Alaska is ranked last in four-year college degree graduates, he is more troubled by that translating into less trained professionals for Alaska's workforce. He stressed the importance of certain programs, such as the Alaska Native Educational Equity Act.
There have been, in the last 10 years, a 108% increase of Alaskan Natives receiving baccalaureates at the University of Alaska. I'm very proud of that until I realize how much more there is to do.
The director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, Carl Rose, said kids don't decide to just drop out. It comes after years of disappointment and disengagement. He says it's critical to identify kids who are struggling early as they first enter kindergarten to assist them and ideally to help families better prepare their children before they ever start school. Rose told his own story of growing up in a socially and economically disadvantaged family of mixed race. He was dyslexic, had a stutter, but still overcame the odds with help.
My point is not me. My point is that if there was support for one person like me, who was a member of all four subgroups, we can do this for all of them. We ought to be. And that's the point. You know, I don't single myself out to tell my story. This is the story of the subgroups. And that's why No Child Left Behind is here. And we cannot retreat from those kids who need us most.
Michael Andrews with the Alaska Works Partnership said apprenticeship programs are clamoring for high school graduates.
And as a result, apprenticeship programs today are competing harder than ever with other industries, post-secondary technical schools, colleges, universities, and the military for those graduates. We have a pipeline to build, a natural gas pipeline to build, and we need high school graduates who can learn those skills to do that work.
Murkowski's staff will be compiling other recommendations from educators throughout this month with a goal of incorporating those into future education legislation in 2009. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a problem bear in Port Armstrong.
5 gallons of soy sauce, 1 gallon of mayonnaise.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Two Fort Wainwright-based soldiers were killed over the weekend in a helicopter crash in Iraq. The Department of Defense reports that Chief Warrant Officers Donald V. Clark and Christian P. Humphreys died from injuries suffered in the crash Saturday. U.S. Army Alaska Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Allen says the soldiers' Kiowa helicopter went down during non-combat operations.
They were on a training mission, and during the training mission, their helicopter crashed near Mosul, Iraq. And once the investigation is complete, then we'll have some idea of what may have gone what may have caused it at that point.
Lieutenant Allen says the incident was listed as non-hostile. Both soldiers killed were pilots. Clark, 37, was from Memphis, Tennessee and assigned to Fort Wainwright in 2006. Humphreys, 28, was from Fallon, Nevada and assigned to Fort Wainwright in April of this year. The Army reports next of kin have been notified and that no one else was injured in the crash. The Army also held a deployment ceremony today at Fort Wainwright for an aviation regiment that's well known to Alaskans. Post spokeswoman Linda Douglas says the medevac unit headed to Iraq has performed many wilderness rescues in the interior.
The MAST mission, which is military assistance to safety and traffic, was a secondary mission for this unit. And yes, they did perform a number of medical missions supporting civilians in remote locations.
Douglas says the unit will be carrying out similar medevac duties in the Iraq war zone during a year-long deployment. She says the aviation regiment has sent some of its members overseas in recent years, but this is the first time the entire group is heading out.
Several years ago, the MAST unit would deploy 2 to 3 crews of 12 to 18 people to Afghanistan, but they did leave a couple of crews back here at Fort Wainwright to handle the MAST mission. The difference is this time the Army has requested the entire unit of about 130 soldiers deploy as one group.
Douglas says the unit's Black Hawk helicopters were shipped to Iraq this summer. A National Guard unit has taken over the responsibilities handling backcountry rescues in interior Alaska. A new study shows positive economic effects of missile defense in Alaska. The University of Alaska Fairbanks study commissioned by missile defense contractor Boeing shows the project contributed $246 million to the state's economy in 2007. UAF economist Hans Geyer says $52 million of that was wages for high-paying jobs.
I think the biggest number that people should be impressed with is the average salary per worker. Base income per worker was $100,000, and then there was an additional $60,000 per worker in benefits.
The study shows a total of 323 Alaskans were employed by Boeing on the missile defense projects in Alaska, most at Fort Greely in Delta Junction, home of the international system's largest interceptor missile launch site. Geyer says the impact of high-paying jobs is significant in a rural area like Delta, where unemployment or where employment is limited. Geyer says for each Boeing job, there were an additional 1.2 jobs created in the community.
Everything from the people who serve the espresso in the morning and sell donuts, you know, up to people who work for suppliers of Boeing for fuel and heavy equipment and many other services.
The combined economic impact of Boeing and other missile defense-driven employment accounted for $72 million in household income in Alaska in 2007. Geyer says most of those employed by Boeing are locals working labor and office jobs. He says the study data does not reflect high-paid professionals or executives imported to the state for the project.
I know many people in Delta Junction, and I know for a fact that they have all received good jobs at this site.
The study shows that state and local governments also benefited by collecting nearly $10 million in tax revenue from missile defense. Boeing's spending in the state is the result of long-running U.S. Department of Defense contracts, and company vice president and general manager of Missile Defense Systems, Scott Fancher, says 2007 economic data does not represent an anomaly.
The spending in 2007 is about the same amount that we're doing here in 2008 and roughly the same amount that we'll do in 2009. Now, in the out years, it's difficult for us to tell. I mean, that'll be really dependent upon what the Congress decides to appropriate and what the administration decides to request Congress to appropriate.
Fancher says the ongoing project work in Alaska involves construction, maintenance, and operation of interceptor missile silos at Fort Greely and construction of a port for a massive floating radar at ADAC. Boeing is one of the world's biggest space and defense businesses. With more than 71,000 employees, the U.S. missile defense project is one of the largest Boeing is involved in. Mm-hmm. Talkeetna is now home to one of the top endangered historical buildings in Alaska. The Alaska Association of Historic Preservation this month placed the Tom Weatherall Cabin on Main Street on their list of the most endangered properties in the state. KTNA's Sue Dio has the story.
The building was constructed in the early 1930s, and according to Chris Mannix, Talkeetna resident and log home builder for the past 30 years, it's unique.
The Weatherall building is got a high level of craftsmanship, and I think that's really cool, and it's really worthy of preservation.
After Tom Weatherall passed away in the 1940s, Missouri Taraski bought the cabin. A few years ago, Suzanne Rust of K2 Aviation and Rust Flying Service in Anchorage purchased the lot and the deteriorating cabin. The structure, now known as the Weatherall Taraski Rust Cabin, is just a small piece of the historic puzzle of Talkeetna. Talkeetna's historic district was developed in 1992 with a lot of hard work and dedication by several people to preserve the historic cabins and buildings of the village. According to the Alaska Association of Historic Preservation, once new buildings overtake the ones that are historic, the historic district look is diminished and the designation is taken away. If the Weatherall cabin is finally consumed by time and tundra, there is a possibility that the historic district sign at the entrance to Talkeetna's Main Street goes away. Mannix says he is saddened by the thought that the Weatherall Rust cabin could go the way of some of the other lost buildings.
We've already seen a couple of landmark log buildings in downtown Talkeetna disappear. We've seen the Bucket of Blood Saloon go. There was the Nagley residence at the end of Main Street. And, you know, they're gone. They're mulch somewhere. And to lose the Weatherall building would just be, that'd be a tragedy.
Mannix is not the only one in Talkeetna interested in preservation of the building. There is a line of concerned residents. At the head of the line is one of the longtime residents of Talkeetna, author Roberta Sheldon, widow of well-known pilot Don Sheldon. Sheldon says she has had friendly conversations with Suzanne Rust to try and persuade her to do something with the building.
And I said, well, you know what? You could do it in stages. You could. The first thing is you jack it up. You pull out the rotten logs. You put in new logs where the rotted places are, and then you put some kind of a concrete pour for a foundation.
And she agrees with Mannix that the cabin is significant.
It's a precious historic building that is so beautiful, and its architecture is of interest too. It was probably the neatest house in town when it was built.
Chris Mannix and his brother Art, both with a fine eye for beautiful wood and craftsmanship, said you can't buy history and the structure still could be saved.
Fortunately, the roof appears to be in reasonably good shape. And that's really important because, you know, once the roof starts leaking, then, you know, water gets inside and things start going.
Suzanne Rust did not return calls for comment on her plans for the structure. Since the building is in private ownership, it is out of the hands of the Talkeetna Historical Society, the entity that cares for some of the other historic structures in town. One of the other properties on the list of endangered is actually the entire historic district of Flat City, which may lose its status on the National Register of Historic Places. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
In a rare public appearance today, former Governor Frank Murkowski spoke about Alaska's economy to a crowd from the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. Murkowski stressed the importance of continuing to push forward with natural resource development in the state despite the worsening national economic crisis. He said lawmakers' next session need to concentrate on making sure the gas line will happen, but he says it's far from a sure thing.
You got to recognize the realities of what causes a company to invest. They go in for the bottom line, the highest return and the least risk. And when you can go anywhere in the world, that means you better be competitive. And just like when you get up in the morning, you look out the window, it's a little different every day. And that's what's happening to the Alaska gas line. It's getting a little more expensive every day, a little more LNG on the market. Costs continue to rise.
Governor Murkowski also pushed for a renewed effort to make the case for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas development.
I believe that Alaska and our legislature must aggressively take the ANWR issue to the American people again. Polls have shown a change on ANWR. With safeguards, there's a majority now that supports it, as well as our native residents of the Arctic.
Murkowski called on the legislature to approve more funding for Arctic Power, the group that lobbies for ANWR development on behalf of the state. He said he wouldn't mind working for the organization since he is so passionate about the issue. Murkowski said he currently has plenty of time on his hands. It will be legal again in some areas of the state for hunters to kill black bears in their dens. Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says the Game Board last week approved a proposal that goes into effect next July to allow the once common but more recently illegal practice in several interior game management units.
To allow resident hunters to use artificial light at den sites between the middle of October and the end of April to take black bears. And salvage of meat is required. So these are more or less traditional methods that were used that local people asked the board to approve.
Harms says the Game Board based its decision on repeated accounts of the practice being used historically in the interior. The Alaska Board of Game also rejected a proposal last week by Nick Yurko of Juneau to extend the season and increase the bag limit for hunting brown bears in Berners Bay. Staff biologists say the population of 60 brown bears in Berners Bay already has enough hunting pressure on it. They based that finding in part on recent research showing that a Berners Bay bear is not your average bear. John
Biologists
Ryan reports,
from the Department of Fish and Game have been putting satellite-linked GPS collars on Berners Bay brown bears for the past 3 years to track their movements. They've also been able to identify individual bears by analyzing the DNA from small samples of fur snagged in specially designed snares. The researchers set up the snares on well-worn bear trails. When a bear walks through the snare, a piece of barbed wire catches a bit of hair. The bear walks away, and the hair eventually gets sent down to a lab in British Columbia for genetic analysis. Putting the GPS and DNA information together, scientists learned that Berners Bay has a genetically unique population of brown bears. The Juneau Ice Field and the city of Juneau keep the bears from mingling their DNA with bears from other areas. And Berners Bay bears don't behave like other brown bears in southeast Alaska. Fish and Game biologist Steve Lewis told the Board of Game that the bears mostly stick very close to sea level instead of sometimes heading up high like other coastal bears.
There's almost no use of alpine at all. In fact, they're rarely using higher than 800 feet in elevation. So they're basically sticking to these river valleys. So that really kind of stuck out initially as a real difference between this population.
Hunters kill about 225 brown bears a year in southeast Alaska, but few are hunted in Berners Bay. Lewis says hunters tend to go after the denser bear populations in other parts of southeast.
Our estimate is 60 bears in all of Berners Bay. On Chichikov, we are finding 55 unique bears using one stream.
The Alaska Department of Transportation funded the bear research as part of its effort to gauge the potential impacts of a highway around the shores of Berners Bay and up Lynn Canal. A Lynn Canal highway would give hunters easier access to the bears' preferred low-elevation habitats. Lewis says current hunting pressures are already a concern to wildlife managers, given the low population of bears in Berners Bay. Fish and Game biologists say they'll be considering emergency orders to close Berners Bay to brown bear hunting. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The community of Port Armstrong on the southern end of Baranoff Island has had a fall visitor who is wreaking havoc around town. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
We call him the pain in the butt.
PA resident Ryan Martin isn't talking about one of his neighbors, but a rogue bear that's been breaking into homes, including Martin's pantry at the Laughing Raven Lodge.
He ate 5 gallons of soy sauce, a gallon of mayonnaise, a lot of our wintertime food, fish and venison and stuff like that. The peculiar thing, the first time he broke in, he got off a box of granola bars and opened up each granola bar individually and ate each one like a person would and throw him on the floor.
Martin says barricading the pantry just proved to be incentive for the bear to show that he isn't about to be deterred.
He is very strong and pulled whatever I put on there with big old screws and nails completely off and made it about 10 times worse the next time.
And a chest freezer lid that the bear decided to rip off by the hinges has marks in the metal, which measures 3 inches between its two fangs. Martin says the lid was destroyed. He says it's usual for bears to be around this time of year, looking to get as much food as they can before going to sleep for the winter. But he says it doesn't seem like last year was this bad, although there was one bear that hung around, and Martin says it could even be the same one. He says the bear goes back and forth between the Track A and Track B town sites in PA, and it has no trouble swimming.
Definitely breaking into other people's houses. It broke into a house right next to ours here and got inside, went through a window, pulled everything off the counters and cupboards and tracked flour all around the house. He's not winning any likable contests.
And he's affecting the social life of Port Alexander residents.
Feels like sometimes we're just got a curfew around dark time around here. Everybody goes to their house and stays, and we don't get a whole lot of company over after dark because people got to walk home, and there's no streetlights here, so it's a little scary.
Martin says the bear also dug up the sewer system at the school, as well as ripping off a metal door on Bear Hall, PA's community hall, which he says is a misnomer. Bears aren't really invited in.
The top of it was bent in like 2 inches, so who knows what it was doing, but you can see muddy paw prints all the way up at the top. I can see him standing on his hind legs, pushing on the door, and actually bent the metal door. And on the inside, you can see where it's creased down by the doorknob.
Martin said it's definitely a nocturnal bear, and it could be male or female. The one night that he and another resident waited up all night for it, the bear decided to go to the other side of the bay. Martin says this bear is not popular in town and probably won't last much longer if it doesn't let up soon. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, John Ryan in Juneau, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Application January 9th. 1-800-478-1456. Una Kingunchtuk, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Office of Subsistence Management.
Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The deadline for applications is January 9th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.